The Real Housewives of Miami Beach meet the PTA. A Miami mom's daughter becomes her transgender son, and Marcus Garvey comes alive in illustration. Welcome to a special encore presentation of the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll revisit conversations we aired last month with local Miami Book Fair authors Asha Elias about her new novel of Miami Beach dysfunction, Pink Glass Houses, Haitian-American educator Isabel Camille about her poignant memoir of her child's transgender journey, Soleil's Mom, and with Jamaican-American poet Jeffrey Phillip about his graphic biography of Black nationalist hero Marcus Garvey for young readers, My Name is Marcus. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special encore broadcast of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, featuring our interviews last month with three of the Miami Book Fair's local authors, Asha Elias, Isabel Camille, and Jeffrey Phillip. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Here is the program we originally aired on November 22nd. The Miami Book Fair. It is the country's largest book fair, and it's our marquee opportunity to show the world that Miami is not the intellectual wasteland that Northeastern snobs and late-night comics make it out to be. Aside from the vibrant downtown street fair, this annual multilingual, multinational gathering features scores of book presentations and discussions that most cities can only dream of hosting. We're devoting this week's program to the Miami Book Fair, specifically to three of its featured local authors. Later on, I'll speak with Jamaican-American poet Jeffrey Phillip about his graphic biography of Black nationalist icon Marcus Garvey. I'll also talk to Haitian-American educator Isabel Camille about her memoir of her daughter's transgender odyssey. But first up is Miami New Times writer Asha Elias. Her debut novel, Pink Glass Houses, is a riveting and often sardonic look at the world of Miami Beach alpha moms and what their battle for control of an elementary school PTA says about all of us here. Consider this a sort of on-air book fair presentation. So with me now in the studio is Asha Elias, here to talk with us about her debut novel, Pink Glass Houses. Asha, thanks for coming in and congratulations on this engaging slice of Miami dysfunction that you've given us in this book.
Thanks so much for having me, Tim.
It's a pleasure. So the novel is set in Miami Beach and focuses on a fictional, high-achieving public elementary school, the Sunset Academy, where control of the PTA is a plumb vehicle for social-climbing moms, many of whom, as you write, dress and talk like teenagers, drive Maseratis and Porsches, and have professional hair and makeup done for school events that take place on Monday afternoons. I should note that one of the moms ridicules all that Gucci excess early in the novel by pointing out that, quote, stilettos at a school function make about as much sense as a thong bikini in a synagogue. The story is told through the eyes of four of the moms, one of whom, Melody, is a recent arrival from Kansas, trying to make sense of a place she calls Mars, literally. Tell us about these moms and the planet Miami Beach you create here.
So one of my favorite comments I receive from out-of-town readers is that the characters are so out over the top and the setting is so over the top. And one of my favorite comments I receive from local readers is that I didn't go far enough. Exactly. So hopefully there is a little bit of truth and reality to the satire that is the Sunset Academy PTA. And I think all four women who are main characters in this book have the best intentions, or think they do. Their number one priority is their children and making the school a better place. But how they go about that is sometimes done with questionable morals.
Right. And so the four moms we have are Charlotte, the alpha mom, as I call her, Melody, as I pointed out, the outsider from Kansas. Mm-hmm. We have Darcy, the sort of dissident in this whole group.
The skeptic.
And then we have Carol, who is the...
The voice of reason, I would say.
Yeah, a judge.
She's an actual judge.
Right. Now, Asha, tell us about your own story and how it dovetails with the novel. You grew up in South Florida, but I get the feeling that you too were taken aback by the rarefied Miami Beach ether when you first landed there, no?
Sure. I've been in Miami Beach since 2009, and I definitely had a Melody-esque fish-out-of-water experience when I first arrived, but in many ways, I'm kind of a Charlotte now and firmly implanted in my Miami Beach momness.
Good word. And so let me ask you then, as a result, given your own story, of all the moms, do you identify most with Melody, or is it Charlotte? Since, as we were just discussing, she was part of a place like Ocean Drive magazine where you once worked, or is it Darcy or Carol, for that matter? Which one do you feel you identify with most?
I see pieces of myself in three of the four characters, in Charlotte in a lot of literal ways, where I was actually the vice president of fundraising for my children's school PTA for many years.
There you go. Know what you write about. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Uh-huh. And I understand that drive for perfection, sometimes at all costs. That being said, I've often felt like a fish out of water, like Melody, where I kind of step back and look at everything and say, what's going on here? And I have a lot of skeptic in myself as well, like Darcy. Mm-hmm. I would say I relate the least with Carol, who I think is the most altruistic of all of the characters. Right. Not that I'm an amoral person, but but she kind of served a purpose in the story.
Yeah.
And
I'm gonna get to a quote of hers later on in the discussion here, but the novel's central tension is Melody's audacious decision to run for PTA president against Sunset's alpha mom Charlotte. And one of the things I really liked about your characterizations here is that you easily could have let this slip into superficial Real Housewives of Miami Beach mode, but you don't. You remind us that even real housewives have very fraught and human backstories. And that's especially true of Charlotte, who I found the most interesting figure in this story. What was it that you're trying to tell us about these women and this world through a character like Charlotte?
Yeah, thank you for that question. To zoom out a little bit, with all the characters, I wanted them to all make preconceived notions about one another, and I wanted them to almost always be wrong. And Charlotte's an easy target because she looks like she has it all together, but she's really fighting her own personal demons. She might hide it well, but she's struggling just as much as anyone else in the book.
Especially when you look at her past, you know, her own youth, suicide problems and things of that nature. You really fleshed her out. By the same token, though, you also paint Melody with more three-dimensional flaws than I think a lot of readers expect, since she's supposed to be the sane and innocent Midwesterner placed in the middle of all this Miami Beach charade, right?
Right, but she's not so innocent.
Yes.
Melody, again, another thing I wanted to do was I wanted readers to have a feeling there was something, someone they were supposed to root for and against when they began reading the book. And I wanted them to constantly question that throughout the course of reading it.
Right.
And so Melody shows up kind of wide-eyed and seemingly innocent. But as her story unfolds, it turns out that she was not so sweet back home.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to play with, sometimes when you begin reading a book and you think you know a character, it's almost impossible to break that initial appearance that you've had of them. So I'm glad if that worked for you.
No. I mean, you know, she starts out saying things like, wow, our rent in Miami Beach, a grocery bill in
right.
Miami Beach is like our rent or our mortgage back in Wichita, you know, but as you say, things are more complicated. But there's another family involved in the Sunset Academy drama, and Don and Patricia Walker, the mega-rich finance and philanthropy lords of the school, whose gaudy new house is the pink glass house of your novel's title. They're native Kentuckians, right?
Correct. Well, the white Patricia is.
Patricia is, right. And they represent what so often turns out to be the myth of Miami as
yes.
a place to reinvent, recreate, rebrand yourself. Or as one mom says, fake it till you make it, till you break it,
mm-hmm.
right? Is that what you're trying to get at with this couple, Don and Patricia Walker?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Miami is a very open city in many ways. It's a place where transients can come into town and work hard and make something and be accepted. The other side of the coin is people can come to town with not so great intentions, and we will embrace them, and we will, especially if they're making large financial contributions to our nonprofit organizations, we'll put their name on buildings, we will celebrate them, and we've been around long enough to know that many times those philanthropists who come into town have sometimes not made their money legally and don't always have the best of intentions. And
right.
And that's what I was trying to do with Don and Patricia Walker.
Now, on the one hand, the Walkers are comic relief. We see Patricia having a meltdown when someone takes her reserved parking spot at the school. And you say, and I love this description. Could you please read it for us?
Sure. By then, Patricia had gone nuclear, which honestly is just unbecoming on such a pretty girl. She was shaking and looked like an electrocuted giraffe in her nude bodysuit and black miniskirt, crocodile Bottega pouch squeezed to death under one arm. She kept running her free hand through her hair and squealing, "My spot! Who would do this?" Like, come on, girlfriend, don't ruin a perfectly good blowout.
Right. But, and I don't want to give away the novel's ending here, but this is also a tragic couple. And I wanted to ask you to read a particularly sad passage in Melody's voice that sort of sums up their emptiness, if not the emptiness of the whole world your story is set in. Could you read that for us as well?
Sure. But I couldn't help feeling sad for Donald and Patricia Walker, too. For all their pretense, pomp, and condescension, something between me didn't want to resign them to frauds. There was something deeply disturbing about the realization, a level of emptiness and despair to their characters that was almost too much to think about. I wondered if I, too, would resort to extreme artifice if my insides were too painful to view, as is, if my authentic self was so disfigured and grotesque that living a lie was preferable.
Yeah, thanks. This is a special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami author Asha Elias about her debut novel about Miami Beach, Pink Glass Houses. So, Asha, jumping off that sobering passage you just read, I wanted to ask you a writer's question. This novel tries to walk a line between lampooning this society and giving it a shoulder to cry on, essentially. As a first-time novelist, how hard was it to strike the right balance between the sardonic attitude and the sympathetic attitude?
Thank you for asking that. I think that it was important to me not to sound too critical of a city that I do truly love. But I did want it to be funny. I did want it to be observational. And I think that that balance really comes with revision, which is a really, you know, uninteresting thing. But it
The best writing is rewriting.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's really time with the manuscript. And to be honest with you, other eyes, having good readers who can sit and say, you're pushing it a little too far here, or maybe you need a pull back here.
Right. Along those lines, I also want to take a step back and look at the larger Miami and Miami Beach questions the story raises. Earlier in the novel, the anti-alpha mom, Darcy, makes a pretty bold statement. Quote, Miami Beach is a microcosm of everything that is wrong with this country right now. Now she's speaking primarily about America's rather third world economic disparities mm-hmm. these days, especially yeah. how the 1% loves to rub our noses in their Prada and Porsches. But what else does Darcy mean there about Miami Beach being a microcosm of America's 21st century dysfunction?
Sure. And I think a lot of that comes down to education as well, where even in this public school, there are avenues for people with privilege to gift their children a better education and better opportunities mm-hmm. than people who don't have the means. And that's done through the always controversial gifted program.
Yes.
Which mm-hmm. Used to be a very merit-based system, I think, at one point in its iteration.
My wife's a teacher. I have heard this complaint before, yes.
And now in many schools in high net worth zip codes, 50% of a school campus is gifted, which should statistically represent 2% of IQs. And the children in the program are people, you know, belong to families who have hired private psychologists to mm-hmm. make sure that they're placed in the program.
Right. So
and
that sort of an elementary nationwide. Version of the high school getting, you know, the best SAT scores and
exactly.
things of that nature. Now, one of the novel's most striking psychoses along those lines is helicopter parenting. Mm-hmm. What did you want to convey about how that has distorted American kids' upbringing today? And what do you consider some of the story's most glaring examples
sure.
of how that plays out in your novel?
Sure. It's funny, just to like pivot a tiny bit, one of the questions I thought was interesting at one of the events I did, someone asked me, if this was when we were in school, how would the story be different? And I said, this story wouldn't happen. My parents didn't know the minutiae of my day the way that I do with my kids and that parents in general do. So I think that, you know, the culture of helicopter parents is rampant, and I myself am guilty of it. And some examples are, you know, the parents aren't letting the kids problem solve on their own. And as a result, they're not learning conflict resolution. And also in the book, the parents aren't handling conflict very, very well amongst themselves.
Yeah. So Charlotte is a lot like a stage mother. I mean, she's like grooming her daughter to be Miss Universe or something, right? And that
to overcompensate for, as you mentioned before, an unhappy childhood that she had.
Right. There's also an unavoidable but multi-layered feminist message in the novel. Career moms versus housewives, of course, but also Miami materialism versus Midwestern simplicity. What does this novel want to tell women today about what to aspire to and what to recoil from?
Sure. I think that I really wanted to examine this female quest for perfection in everything. And the, you know, finding a balance between being the perfect mom, the perfect career woman, if you're still working, it's impossible. I really believe that. And these women, the source of all of their problems is trying to be everything at once to everyone.
Right. You've got Darcy trying to be a lawyer. And I think the time she spends with her job makes her really resent watching people like Charlotte be able to do so much at the school. Mm-hmm. But then you've got people like Charlotte who resent the working mom for feeling like she's their superior.
Right. She's not getting respect for the work that she's, the unpaid work that she's doing.
And she makes a really interesting observation. She says, look, because she did used to work at a magazine a lot like Ocean Drive, where she makes this observation that, hey, whether you're selling $1 million worth of ads or getting a $20,000 donation for school supplies, it's all the same hustle.
It's the same hustle, she says.
I thought that was a great line. The novel, though, ends on a rather pessimistic note when the mom, who's a judge, Carol, concluding that Miami is, quote, the antithesis of justice, a haven where people come to avoid justice. What should Miami take from the bizarre story of these moms about how to become the city it wants the world to take seriously for a change, would you say?
Yeah, I wish I had the answer for that, because, again, I do think that this is in many ways the most open and livable city in the country. But at the same time, we're just not great at holding people accountable.
Yeah.
I don't know how we change that as a culture, but I'd love to see it happen.
Yeah. Well, let's hope, you know, books like this, if you know, tend to prompt people in that direction. I really do hope so. Miami author Asha Elias's debut novel is Pink Glass Houses. She'll discuss the book tomorrow at 11 a.m. at Miami-Dade College's downtown building 8, and on Sunday at 11 a.m. as well, right, at the Pavilion.
That's right.
Asha, many thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, Isabel Camus' memoir, Soleil's Mom, takes us on the redemptive journey of a transgender son. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome back to this special encore broadcast of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, featuring our conversations last month with three of the Miami Book Fair's local authors. In the earlier segment, I spoke with Miami New Times writer Asha Elias about her debut novel, Pink Glass Houses. In this segment, I talk with Haitian-American educator Isabel Camus about her memoir, Soleil's Mom. Let's return to the program we originally aired on November 22nd. Few culture war issues shake the country more today than transgenderism. We've seen debates erupt over whether minors should receive gender-affirming medical care or whether transgender girls and women should be allowed to participate in female sports. But one thing that's not debatable for most parents of transgender persons is that their children should be loved and accepted for who they are or for who they've become. Not that being a parent of a transgender person is easy. It can be extraordinarily difficult, painful even, to watch a daughter become a son or vice versa. But it can also be a strengthening and enlightening odyssey, as it was for Isabel Camus, as she recounts in her poignant memoir, Soleil's Mom, A Transgender Journey of Love, Loss, and Letting Go.
As her daughter Sole transitioned to her now son, Sky, Camille had to wrestle not only with society's prejudices, including those of her native Haiti, but with her own misconceptions as well, just as we all would, if we're being perfectly honest. Joining me now in the studio is Isabelle Camille. Isabelle, welcome and congratulations on this very important memoir.
Thank you.
Isabelle, before we talk about your son Sky's story, tell us about yours. You're originally from Haiti and you're now a retired high school chemistry teacher, right?
Right. I retired 3 years ago from Dade County Public School and Miami-Dade College. And I taught chemistry for, I came to the States back in 1972, mm-hmm. and I went to college at University of Florida and came to Miami and started teaching. I taught at Coral Gables Senior High and Coral Reef Senior High and taught chemistry all these years and loved it and now loving retirement.
And you said originally from Port-au-Prince.
Originally from Port-au-Prince.
And it came correct. In 72. Was your family perhaps escaping the Duvalier dictatorship?
Finished with high school, okay. Coming to college, university. My plan was to go back to Haiti once I was done with, but then I met my husband and that was it, my life.
Now, you tell readers up front in the memoir why you wrote this. On the one hand, you say in heartbreaking fashion that this is your, quote, swan song to Sole, the child I have lost. On the other, it's a celebration of Sky, the son you have gained.
Yes.
But tell us why you felt compelled to tell both of those stories. Was it family closure, societal acceptance?
Family closure a lot, my personal closure also. And trying to understand what is it that has happened and not wanting to really lose Sole. It was a lot also. You'd read article about parents who are having such difficulties with their children, transgender children or LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to help them understand it's not the end. If you accept, if you try as much as you can to understand what is going on, you need to accept. And mm-hmm. so that was one of my goal in writing the book.
Now, your Haitian background plays a large role in this story, starting with a Haitian folk song called La Tibonie.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear Haitian singer T-Corn's beautiful rendition of this song, you know intuitively that you're finally going to have a daughter after mm-hmm. having sons. Mm-hmm. And I want to play a bit of T-Corn singing La Tibonite here.
Lovely.
La Tibonite moi vive, La Tibonite, yo voye pale moi, yo dim sole malade. La Tibonite, yo voye pale moi, yo dim sole malade. Le moi vive.
We can hear Sole in the song there, mm-hmm. and this turns out to be prophetic, no? In
yes.
terms of signaling that you're going to have a daughter whom you'll name Sole, which means son in Haitian Creole, but also that this Sole won't last.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
In the book, I went through how we name all our four children. And from the very first one, we always said, if we have a daughter, we'll call her Sole. But in Haiti, the name Sole is not welcome because of the fact that it is telling the story of someone who is dying.
The son is
the,
dying.
Right.
Yeah.
The son, exactly.
Yeah.
And therefore...
S-U-N, not S-O-N.
Right.
Yeah,
and therefore, my mother, my parents, everyone, no, Sole is not, you know, it's telling of a dying person. No. But we love the name, and so we wanted to have that name. When I had, when I had my test and they tell me it's a son, that I was going to have a
right.
son,
mm-hmm.
and then I get in my car and I hear that song and I thought, okay, this is the universe telling me you are having a daughter.
A daughter, right.
And
mm-hmm.
that daughter is going to be named Sole.
Mm-hmm.
And now, after I've had, you know, going through the transition, I wonder, was it prophetic in terms of finding a name that is someone who is dying and therefore right. someone else
because
coming.
Because as we'll remind people, that the song is essentially talking about the son dying.
Right.
And so again, it becomes a double-edged prophecy for you in that sense. Take us through the early part of your daughter Soleil's path to becoming your son, Sky. You describe all the, quote, tomboy differences you see as her gender dysphoria becomes more apparent, and you describe your internal struggle between accepting, if not embracing, that metamorphosis she's going through, but on the other hand, hoping it will pass like a phase.
Yes.
And you recognize that you were telling yourself, as you put it beautifully in the book, the lies we weave to appease our hearts.
Yes, yes. It was, you know, all of the no toys, no dolls, no pink dresses, and so on. And we accepted it a bit quickly, my husband and I. And afterwards, as we get to the point of the transition, the question was, did we accept it too quickly? Maybe if we had pushed more on the pink dresses and the dolls and so on, maybe that would not, she would not have found herself in that position.
Right.
And it's a therapist that we so insisted on understanding, for us to understand, no, you don't make someone become transgender.
There's nothing you could have done to change what her body and soul was telling her, what she really is inside.
And this is the part that I really wish parents, because the book is written for parents, to help parents understand what, it's a heart-wrenching situation, but you want parents to understand they are like that, and it's not something that we do, and now we say, oh, it's society. It's not society. Soleil was in herself. She was a man. She felt that way.
Now, I myself have a transgender goddaughter who's doing very well in college, male or female. She's still a brilliant philosophy major. I have friends who are parents of transgender persons, and I was struck in your memoir by your very welcome and reassuring honesty about how difficult the transgender journey can be, even for friends and family who consider themselves enlightened about the changing nature, the fluidity, as you call it in the book, of gender identity today. You write that you'd always been very accepting of LGBTQ persons, and at one point you admit that if Soleil had just been a lesbian, this would have been easier. As you put it, quote, suddenly the complications of being transgender seemed to make homosexuality more attractive. How do you hope the memoir will navigate us through those complications to the love and acceptance that transgender persons like your son, Sky, deserve, just like everyone else?
Yes. We have, part of the issue of being transgender, as a parent, you always wish that your child would be in a good relationship, would find a partner in life. And now as a transgender, and that's why I thought as a homosexual, it would be easier maybe for her to find a partner, but as a transgender, it complicates things. And to me, I wanted this person, this child of mine, to when I go, to know that she or he is in a relationship with someone who will support her or him throughout life. And that makes it very difficult now.
You want them to be loved.
You
want any child, to be loved. This is a special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup. I'm Tim Padgett on WLRN. I'm speaking with Miami author Isabel Camille about her memoir Soleil's Mom, A Transgender Journey of Love, Loss, and Letting Go. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the show, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Isabel, one of the things I think your memoir shows us most effectively isn't so much your courage during this journey, it is courageous, but rather how your child's courage through it all, especially in the face of all the cruelties society hurls at transgender persons, how his courage prompted you to become more courageous. I was particularly struck by Sky's fairly noble response to one incident when he was working at McDonald's, for example. Tell us about how that dynamic played out between the two of you.
He was working at McDonald's and made a mistake in someone's order, and the man got very upset and threw the drink at him and said, what is that? Is that a she-man now? And he understood, but then the staff also of McDonald's, they were really supportive of him, mm-hmm. and they actually asked the guest to leave.
Right.
And so but then he doesn't hold anything. He didn't understand mom. He didn't get it, mm-hmm. and that's always been his response to people's.
And I got the sense that courageous response on his part really affected then how you were able to overcome your
right. mm-hmm.
reservations about his transgenderism mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. acceptance, no?
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
and made would you say that made you a more courageous person than
yes,
I
yes.
mean that definitely comes through, as I said in the book. Now, you come from a Haitian Roman Catholic background, and I'm glad that your memoir confronts the religious elephant in the room, as it were, when it comes to transgenderism. One of the questions you take on most directly is this argument from those who oppose transgenderism, saying that it implies that, quote, God made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And your answer to that seems to be no. Transgenderism, like homosexuality, is not a deviation from God's plan, but simply a variation of God's plan. Am mm-hmm. I reading that right?
Yes, yes, you are.
Tell us more about how you feel about that. Because I think, as I said, that religious component, I think, plays a very large mm-hmm. part, not mm-hmm. just in people who oppose transgenderism,
yeah.
but how we come to accept transgenderism. Mm-hmm.
I have an aunt who is a very religious woman, extremely religious, and she was one of the first person actually who made me step back and look at this idea of God's mistake and so on. Once we were having some serious issue with the family accepting Skye, and finally one day she said, but Isabel, you have to realize that you love Soleil, but God loves her more than you cannot love her more than God does.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made me realize, wait a minute, all these negative that people are saying, oh, it's a sin, God allows it. It's God's plan. It was God's plan for Soleil to be Skye.
Mm-hmm.
And
right. Now, toward that end, could I ask you to read what I thought was one of the most salient passages of your book, describing, as you call it, the light that comes at the end of this uncertain tunnel?
Yes, we've had to deal with this deep despair that made our Soleil want to turn off this bright light that she's given off from birth. And if it means acknowledging that our Soleil is gone and now a young man has been introduced into our lives, I am in. Losing Soleil has required a profound emotional adjustment, a process of grieving and acceptance intertwine. And if the name Soleil, our sunshine, is no more, Skye will be our bright moon. Skye's journey signifies a transformation within our family, a new phase where light persists in a different form. He chose his new name well.
He chose. That's wonderful.
Thank
chose
you.
His new name well.
Thank you.
Finally, Isabel, I want to mention that you dedicate this book to the Yes Institute,
yes.
An organization that helped both Skye and your family through this journey. Can you tell us a little bit about the Yes Institute and how families can find groups like it to lean on?
Oh, it's important. It's important because it is such a very different situation, that very difficult situation. You need to find people who can support you. And the Yes Institute, I give them all props to the success that we've had with the transition of Soleil.
And they are based here in Miami?
They are based here in Miami,
okay.
On Sunset. And they help all LGBTQs, and they help all teenagers, not just transgender, but LGBTQ. And they have supported Soleil, Skye. At first, we were, again, this negative, they're accepting it too quickly. Maybe they're the ones pushing, until I started realizing, no, they actually are helping this person grow and mm-hmm. and be accepted and have a good life.
So again, there are organizations out there that yes. people can turn yes. to mm-hmm. to help them see, you know, mm-hmm. the picture that you were yeah. able then.
And they've been extremely supportive now with the book, also inviting me to do many. Mm-hmm.
No, that's great. Haitian American educator Isabelle Camille's new memoir is Soleil's Mom, a transgender journey of love, loss, and letting go. Camille will present the book at Miami-Dade College's downtown Building 8 on Sunday at noon. Thanks very much, Isabelle. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Really glad to have been here.
Still to come, a graphic biography of Black nationalist icon Marcus Garvey. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN.
I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome back to this special encore broadcast of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, featuring our conversations last month with three of the Miami Book Fair's local authors. In the earlier segments, I spoke with Asha Elias about her debut novel Pink Glass Houses and Isabelle Camille about her memoir Soleil's Mom. In this final segment, I talk with Jamaican-American poet Jeffrey Phillip about his graphic book for young readers, My Name is Marcus. Let's return to the program we originally aired on November 22nd.
When it comes to Black civil rights heroes, late 20th century names like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X tend to dominate the conversation. But one early 20th century icon is too often overlooked, even though he laid much of the foundation for what we know today as the Black Pride Movement. That was the Jamaican-born Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey, who in the 1910s and 20s founded organizations like the Universal Negro Improvement Association and the Black Star Line Shipping Company. Garvey is a figure young people in Jamaica, the U.S., and around the world should know more about, which is why Jamaican-American poet Jeffrey Phillip has written a graphic biography for young readers titled My Name is Marcus. It tells Garvey's story through the eyes of Garvey himself, with striking illustrations from his early days as a labor leader in Jamaica to his pioneering civil rights and Black nationalist work in the U.S. to his controversial mail fraud conviction and his exile to England. Joining me now in the studio is Jeffrey Phillip. Jeffrey, welcome and congratulations on this important and innovative piece of historical writing for young people.
Thank you, Tim.
Jeffrey, when you were growing up in Jamaica, would you say the historical figure of Marcus Garvey was as important as the historical presence of Malcolm X would be to a young person growing up in, say, Harlem?
It's one of the great shames of Jamaica that Marcus Garvey is not taught in our schools. We are only now asking the government, petitioning the government, to allow even this book to be taught in our schools.
Andrew Holness is not, for example, come out in support of...
Well, it's not just him. I mean, every successive government since 1962 or 64, when Garvey was named first national hero, he has not been taught. The only way that I picked up on Marcus Garvey was through listening to music by people like Burning Spear, Peter Tosh, Bob Marley,
right.
And in my youth, hanging out with Rastafari.
Uh-huh.
And that is how I learned about Marcus Garvey.
I cannot imagine a figure like Marcus Garvey not being important in the upbringing of kids from places like Trenchtown.
Yes, but part of the problem is the government and many other civic groups are depending upon the musicians to give us an education about Marcus Garvey.
Good point. As we mentioned, this is a graphic biography, one that's told in panels of illustrations with narrative and dialogue balloons.
Yes.
And I should mention, it's vividly illustrated by Shaquille Cross and Marcel Hemmings. This has become a very popular book genre today. I'm thinking of the best-selling Iran memoir Persepolis, for example,
right.
and Worm by Miami's own
yes.
Adele Rodriguez. But why did you decide it would be an especially good vehicle for conveying Marcus Garvey to younger readers?
Well, I grew up reading comics, and I still read comics.
Yeah.
My daughter works at a comic book store in Atlanta. So comics have always been a part of my life. And I could have written another book for grown-ups. But especially because this one of the main themes of this book is perseverance. And I've seen it too often. I've seen too many kids give up because they don't have a role model, because they don't have a story that teaches them about perseverance. So what I did was I said, okay, let me teach the children about Marcus Garvey and at the same time teach them about perseverance.
Right. But what's the challenge of conveying a figure like Garvey to young readers? What is the narrative message about the man that you decided would best explain, for example, what a black nationalist hero is to an elementary or middle school student? I was struck, for example, by one panel where Garvey is standing in front of the spirits of his African and Jamaican forebears, like the slave revolt leaders known as the Maroons, one of whom he was descended from. And the narrative there is simply that he wanted to be, quote, someone of whom my ancestors would be proud. Does that distill it all more effectively for young minds?
Yes, because you give them number one, an image, and number two, you have the words. And it's perhaps even more effective now as we move into this sort of TikTok era in which images matter more even than words. Somebody call it, we live in a post-literacy society. So I think the children would respond easier or better to a story told in pictures and words.
Mm-hmm. What then are the most important facets of Marcus Garvey's life that you hope young or even older readers take from the book? I mean, the man's work across national borders to build black pride from Kingston to New York to London was remarkable and ahead of its time in many ways. So what do you want most for people, especially young people, to see in his legacy?
Well, Marcus Garvey really gave us two charges. The first was to free ourselves physically, which we have done. Most of the islands of the Caribbean and indeed in Africa are now relatively free, but nationally free.
Yeah, I mean, we should point out he was doing his work 40 years before Jamaica became an independent country. Yeah.
Yes. The second charge was to free ourselves, we must emancipate ourselves from mental slavery. And what he defined that, Tim Snyder did a wonderful thing the other day, living inside someone else's story. Mm-hmm. That's what tyranny is. And for too long, we've been living inside the Western story of who and what black people should be. Mm-hmm. And so Garvey gave us a way forward. And in fact, Garvey said it 100 years ago. If the Negro is not careful, he will drink all the poisons of the Western world and die. And so that, if you go to Kingston right now, it's packed with cars, you know, when we should be actively working to mitigate climate change. And so things like that are very necessary. Mm-hmm. Places like Paris are turning over to bicycles, but we're still caught in the whole idea of this is what progress means. Mm-hmm. This is what being Western or whatever that means.
But a lot of that had to do also with him reaching back to Africa, which is why he started the Black Star Line Shipping Company to create more commerce and exchange between Africa and African Americans in this hemisphere, right?
And I'm glad you pointed that out, because a lot of people are still stuck in the idea that Garvey wanted to take all African Americans or Jamaicans, people of African descent, back to Africa.
Right.
He said, some of you are no good here, so why would I want to take you back to Africa?
Right. What he wanted was an exchange reach back to their roots. Right. This is a special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Jamaican-American poet and author Jeffrey Phillip about his new graphic biography of Marcus Garvey for young readers. It's titled My Name is Marcus. Jeffrey, one of the other challenges of writing a book like this for younger readers is explaining adult controversies like Garvey's controversial and, as FBI documents today acknowledge, the racially motivated 1923 conviction here in the U.S. for mail fraud. His sentence was commuted 4 years later under the condition that he leave the U.S. and return to Jamaica. Then he lived the rest of his life later in England until he died in 1940. How hard was it to break that sort of information down in this book format for younger readers?
Justin Hansford has written a great book called Jailing a Rainbow. It's also, the introduction is in a PDF format. So Justin Hansford's work really provided me with the background in order to break it down.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows how Garvey was convicted of mail fraud on an empty envelope.
Yeah.
You know, that was brought
well, as I said, even the FBI acknowledges today that what the agency did back then was just racially motivated.
Racially motivated, yeah. And Hoover had a personal vendetta.
Edgar J. Hoover, the head of the FBI, right?
Against yeah. Garvey.
Right.
And so what happened was Garvey was convicted and later sentence commuted. But Garvey was the sort of scratching pad, because the tactics that he employed with Garvey, he later used on Malcolm X.
And Martin Luther
Martin
King.
Martin Luther King,
right.
And every other black leader that has ever come along.
Good historical point. 7 years ago, I spoke with Garvey's son, Julius
yes.
Garvey, about why outgoing President Barack Obama should have given Marcus Garvey a full pardon, but didn't. Do you feel Obama missed a chance to correct the historical record and also raise the profile of civil rights icons in that moment?
I believe he missed a great opportunity. And remember, part of my mission here in writing this book is really to educate and inspire young kids. I mean, I've worked in middle schools, I've worked in college, I've seen what happens when a child grows up. You know, about when every black child, by the time they reach the age of 10 or 11, they realize this world isn't made for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's either going full revolt or going deeper into what Du Bois called double consciousness.
Right.
You're increasingly looking at yourself through others' eyes.
Double consciousness.
And what Garvey says to us is, look at ourselves through our own, as he said, Ethiopian spectacles.
I'm glad you mentioned Du Bois, because by the same token, I also wanted to ask you how difficult it is to decide what to leave in and out of a biography like this for younger readers. And I'm talking specifically about some of Garvey's flaws as well. My Name is Marcus, for example, does not touch on the feuds that he had with other civil rights leaders at that time, like W.E.B. Du Bois, or the accusations that he promoted racial separation, or some of the anti-Semitic remarks he made after his mail fraud trial. How do you walk the line there between hagiography and more of a warts and all presentation when your readers are young?
Well, you know, we don't talk about all the sins of Hamilton, yet I've seen Hamilton at least 5 times.
Right. Yeah.
So it's telling the story. They will find out all of these other details. For example, the story leaves off in 1937 when he gives his great speech
in
Nova Scotia.
I think in Canada,
in
right.
Canada. Mm-hmm. But they'll find out later how Garvey died of a heart attack, should I say heartbreak,
right,
when the Chicago Defender published a story that he, in fact, had died. Garvey read the story and died of a heart attack.
Right.
So all of these other things, what I want to do more than anything else is to inspire young men and women mm-hmm. about this story that I found very inspiring.
Jeffrey, in just the minute we have left, I also wanted to remind our listeners that you are one of this community's best poets as well. And I think if Garvey were alive today, he'd want us to recognize a Jamaican-born poet like yourself in a conversation about his legacy. When I read poems of yours like Archipelagos, which essentially describes how climate change has made the hurricanes that ravage the Caribbean
yes.
more monstrous, I am genuinely reminded of the work of the late Caribbean Nobel laureate Derek Walcott, for example, in his work Homeros. As a Jamaican, what do you try to convey in your poetry that you were trying to convey in your prose work about Marcus Garvey? And we only have about 20 seconds left.
Climate justice. That's all it is. This Caribbean is going to be impacted by damages that we did not cause. So we must find a way to find climate justice.
Jamaican-American poet Jeffrey Phillip is the author of the graphic biography of Marcus Garvey for young readers titled My Name is Marcus. He will present the book tomorrow at Miami-Dade College's Downtown Building 8 at 2 p.m. Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
That was a rebroadcast of the special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup we aired on November 22nd. And finally on the Roundup today, while the holidays are still with us, we want to remind you about the important holiday charity at our news partner, the Miami Herald, known as Wishbook. It offers one of the best opportunities you'll have at this time of year to give back to the South Florida community and help families here with special financial, medical, and other urgent needs. People like Brianna Carter, who grew up in foster care and now at 22, as a Broward College student, is raising her younger brothers. Hialeah teenager Nicholas Katrib, who has cerebral palsy and scoliosis and whose family struggles to pay for his therapy. Or little 5-year-old Tristan Royal Jr., who has cerebral palsy and autism and is living with his own struggling family in a Florida City hotel. To help these Wishbook nominees and more than 100 others, visit miamiherald.com/wishbook to find out how to donate. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, Happy New Year, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.